Hello and welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. I'm your aptly named host. We have a listener of the week, the Child Care Resource Center in Palmdale, California. At the Nonprofit Technology Conference, three people from there signed up to be Nonprofit Radio Insiders. Now, two have unsubscribed. No, that's not true. These three, very special thanks, Jamie Smith, Lucy Capuro, and Evelyn Juarez. Thanks for being Nonprofit Radio Insiders. Thanks for loving Nonprofit Radio. Shout out to our listener of the week, the Child Care Resource Center in Palmdale, California. Oh, I'm glad you're with me. I'd get a Bartonella henselae infection if you cattily told me that you missed today's show. Secrets of Google Analytics. Do you want to use Google Analytics smarter? Devin Smith is co-founder of Measure Creative, and Julia Robinson is manager of communications at Business for Social Responsibility, BSR. We talked at the 2016 Nonprofit Technology Conference. And what's permissible advocacy? How much can your nonprofit participate in our presidential election season? Can you educate, endorse, lobby? Gene Takagi walks us through what's allowed, disallowed, and questionable. He's our legal contributor and principal of NEO, the Nonprofit and Exempt Organizations Law Group. On Tony's Take Two, don't let planned giving questions go unanswered. We're sponsored by Pursuant, full-service fundraising. Data-driven and technology-enabled, you'll raise more money. Pursuant.com. Also by Crowdster, online and mobile fundraising software for nonprofits. Now with Apple Pay for mobile donations, Crowdster.com. Here are Devin Smith and Julia Robinson from the Nonprofit Technology Conference on Google Analytics.
Welcome to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio coverage of 16 NTC. That's the Nonprofit Technology Conference, of course. And this is also part of NTC Conversations. We're in San Jose at the Convention Center, and my guests are Devin Smith and Julia Robinson. Their session topic is Hidden Secrets of Google Analytics, and we're going to get into that very shortly, right after we cover today's this interview's swag item, which is these small stickers from benevolent.net. They read be fierce, be bold, be inspired. benevolent.net, and these join the swag pile for the conference. All right, let's get into Hidden Secrets of Google Analytics with Devin Smith, who is co-founder of Measure Creative, and she's sitting closest to me, and Julia Robinson, manager of communications at BSR, Business for Social Responsibility. Welcome, Julia, Devin, welcome.
Thank you.
All right, pleasure. I have this backwards. Devin, you're sitting closest to me.
I am.
Yes. Did I just say this backwards? Oh, no. I said Devin's sitting closest to me. Yeah. And Julia, you're over there.
That's correct.
You are Julia. Okay. You are Devin. All right. Very good. Google Analytics. Now, this is sort of an advanced session that you ran.
Yeah.
But I am not an advanced knowledgeable person of Google Analytics. So you're going to have to help me along. And, okay, we'll do the best we can. Let's see what you talked about here. It's, labyrinthine corners.
Yes.
Okay, so let's start with this. Devin, what is it that nonprofits sometimes have trouble with around Google Analytics? What are we not getting quite right?
Yeah, good question. So I think a lot of nonprofit organizations get really intimidated by Google Analytics because there's so many buttons to push and reports to look at, so many options of what you might want to look at. And so people just open up Google Analytics, get kind of nervous, click around, and then shut it down and are like, nope, it's too much. I can't handle it.
Yeah.
So this session was trying to show them, if you only looked at four reports in all of Google Analytics, what should those four reports be? And then we had a couple of other topics as well.
Okay. Oh, but so we could break it down to four reports?
Yeah.
And still be an advanced user?
Exactly.
Oh, so did
that's
you
not
move,
so hard.
Did you move people from my voice cracked again, like I'm 16, 14. Did you move people from basic to advanced, or they were already advanced and now they're super users?
C- good question. I mean, I think it was a mix of people in the audience. I mean, there were definitely people there who, you know, we said, if you've opened up Google Analytics, got nervous and shut it down, like, that's okay. We'll help you out with that.
Oh, okay.
Or if you are a pretty advanced user, but you want to kind of take it to the next level, we can also help you do that with new front-end code, new kind of administrative settings that would actually help you take it even further than you've been able to before.
Okay. All right. So, Julia, why don't we start with these four reports. You concur with Devin, I presume.
That yeah, absolutely.
Four reports, and okay, I just want to make sure there's no dissension in this panel of two. Okay, all right. So why don't we start with the four report? These reports that give us an overview of the four reports. What would we gain from these four reports that we're going to talk about shortly?
I would say first off, it as Devin says, that it does kind of help you. Narrow down what you're looking at. It can be a little bit scary at first to start in Google Analytics. And I would also say that it having that narrow focus means that you can actually go much deeper to understand Google Analytics is an extremely powerful tool, and I think a lot of nonprofits don't realize that, that you can go down to even understanding who specific users, maybe not a person's name, but a certain institution or a founder, foundation or something like that. You can look at that information.
Mm-hmm. What they're doing on your site?
Exactly.
So that's the first report that we looked at is who's browsing your website and what are they doing?
What a transition. Okay. Devin, what is this first report called?
It's called the Service Provider Report.
Service Provider Report. Okay.
Yeah, which is not a very descriptive name, but it's basically the Internet Service Provider, the name of the organization who is using Internet to browse your website.
Oh, so we get ISP, I guess.
Exactly, yeah.
And then from that, we could glean what Julia just said.
Exactly. Yeah, so Google knows the name of the organization who owns that ISP, and so they will tell you what the name of that organization is.
Oh, they'll give you the organization name?
Yeah,
not just
the
ISP?
Exactly.
Oh, I mean, not just the...
not just the number, but actually the name.
What's that number called? What am I saying? What am I missing? Not your ISP, but your...
Your IP address.
IP, thank you. Okay, yes. They'll not give you not just the IP address, but actually name of the...
Exactly.
Holy cow.
So it's an incredibly powerful report, and probably the most underused report in all of Google Analytics is actually seeing who is looking at your website.
All right, the service provider report. Well, how do we select it, set it up? What do we do? What do we need to know about this?
It's just a selection. It's called in the audience section, and then technology, and then service provider. So there's kind of a couple different layers you have to go through.
Exactly. Pull downs or something?
Yep.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I don't do the analytics for my site. We have analytics at TonyMartinetti.com, but I don't set them up. But we do talk about them every month. So and we react to them. And so I feel like
You should ask your analyst to provide you which are the organizations looking at your website.
With the service provider report. Okay. So lead us through the path again. I was too amazed by what... Go ahead.
It goes from audience to technology to service provider.
Okay. And then what do we do? Just select this report?
Just select that report. And what we actually talk about in the session is when you first see the report, it actually doesn't look very useful because a lot of the top results are things like Verizon, AT&T, Comcast. They're all the like generic internet service providers that serve internet to you at your home or on a mobile device. And so what we looked at in the session was actually screening out those not useful results just to look at the organizations that you actually care about.
Oh.
Like the government, like funders, like other nonprofits,
depends.
Your peers.
Yeah.
Depends who you want to look
at. All right.
At.
So, Julia, how do we screen out the ones that are not interesting to us?
So you actually do have to go in and look at what list is coming up, and it'll usually give you, even thousands of results. And you have to go in and see who are the top users and then are those people that you want to hear from. So sometimes I'll go into a segment for government, maybe, and a communications agency will pop up on that list, and then we'll just make sure to exclude them.
All right, and how do you exclude?
I am not sure. Devin?
It's in an advanced segment. You have to build a segment of those organizations that you care most about. So in the government segment, you might say, I want the name of any organization that includes city of, state of, department of, agency of, and it'll just bring you back a list of all those organizations who include that particular series of names. And the same works with an exclusion. So if a name appears in that list because they're the City of New York Library, but library isn't really a government institution, so you might exclude the word library from your list.
So you can select or exclude.
Exactly.
In the same way.
Exactly.
Okay. All right, so we need to get down, let's assume that the these big ones like Verizon, Comcast, et cetera, are not of interest to us. We need to get down to where we really want to be. Otherwise, I mean, they're in the report, right? But we have to continually sift through all these top-level ones that we're not interested in.
Yeah, so once you apply
we exclude them.
Right, so once you apply that advanced segment, then those ones you don't care about go away, and you just see the ones you actually care about.
Okay, an advanced segment. Yes. Now, what does that mean? We have Jargon Jail on Tony Martin at Nonprofit Radio, and I'm concerned that this session is going to be very Google Analytics jargony.
Yes,
all right,
it
so
is.
What is an advanced session?
An advanced segment.
Segment.
Is it's named by Google Analytics, so unfortunately I can't change the name at all.
All right.
But an advanced segment is a way to temporarily exclude information from the report you're looking at. So if you say, I'm looking at the report, but I only want to see, you know, a couple of the organizations in this long list of 1,000, you would apply an advanced segment to that report, and then you only see the organizations you care about.
Okay. Every time you get this report.
Exactly.
Okay.
You're tuned to Nonprofit Radio. Tony Martinetti also hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a quick, 10-minute burst of fundraising insights published once a month. Tony's guests are expert in crowdfunding, mobile giving, event fundraising, direct mail, and donor cultivation. Really, all the fundraising issues that make you wonder, am I doing this right? Is there a better way? There is. Find the Fundraising Fundamentals archive at tonymartinetti.com. That's MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. Thousands of listeners have subscribed on iTunes. You can also learn more at the Chronicle website, philanthropy.com. Fundraising Fundamentals, the better way.
How do we receive these reports? Can we get them by email? We have to go to analytics.google.com? What?
Good question. So we covered automated email reports in the session, actually. So once you've gone through all those clicks to get to this really kind of sophisticated report, you don't want to have to recreate that process every time.
Yeah.
So you can actually set an automated email, and that email can get sent out with a PDF of that report on any time series you like to the list of stakeholders that would actually care about that information.
Okay. Okay.
Like yourself with the website, if you didn't want to wait for the monthly reporting, but you wanted, you know, every week a list of the top organizations browsing your website, you could actually get that sent to you straight from Google and what they were looking at.
Okay, very good. Or the social manager could.
Exactly.
Yes, all right. What else, Julia, should we know about the service provider report? Anything more you want to tell us?
I would say that the thing that can be tough going from getting that information is to then knowing what to do with it. So you have the information, you have this great data. What do you then do? How do you change your strategy so that you know, you can take advantage of it?
Yeah.
So for example, we use it to look at potential partners, and then we can understand, okay, this partner is visiting our website a lot. Maybe it's time to give them a call.
Okay. Do we know what pages different partners or potential partners or whatever organizations on the list have visited? And
absolutely.
And how long they've stayed on each page? Do we know that too?
All that information is available, yes. So
it's all in the service provider report?
Yes.
It's incredible. So by organization, I can see that they looked at my contact page and they looked at this particular podcast page, you know, whatever, this show post.
And that they've downloaded a podcast, that they've, you know, spent 20 minutes on the site listening to the podcast, you know, any of those things.
Holy cow.
Yeah, it's pretty scary.
Amazing. Service provider report. Okay. Let's go to our next of four. What's the other one? What's another one?
The next one was, I think, a channel source report. So kind of how people arrive to your website from someone else's website, whether that was Twitter or some other organization who linked to your website. It's an acquisition report.
Okay. This is just the referring...
The referring domains.
Domains.
Exactly.
Yeah. Don't we know that already? That's not very commonly known? Or?
So what we did in this particular instance is Google just gives you a long list of thousands of different websites who sent traffic to your site.
Yeah.
It's helpful when you can group those names together that are similar. So in BSR's case, you know, they have a bunch of kind of job listing sites that send traffic to their site for job seekers. They have other media partners like New York Times or Fast Company. When you can see all those sources that are similar together and then actually start to see the trends of traffic from media versus partners versus, you know, other types of organizations. So just being able to kind of put more finer detail on that
cluster the data by type. Okay.
Exactly.
Julia, can you explain how we do this in the channel sources report? Source report. Channel source report.
I'm going to kick that back over to Devin, actually, because really? She's more technical than me.
Okay. We'll give you a chance. You'll introduce the next report, for sure. All right.
Yeah, so just to give a little bit of background, so Julia is a client of our agency. So we're often the ones kind of building reports or talking to Julia about what she wants to see in a report, and then we'll build it, and then she'll be able to actually use the information with her stakeholders. When you're building... when you're clustering these organizations together, it's really applying that same advanced segment technique. So you're building an advanced segment that defines who you consider a media source. And so you might say, here are the top 20 media sources for our organization. And now when I want to see just what those 20 media organizations are doing, I apply an advanced segment and any report in Google Analytics I can actually see from those people.
Can you choose the names of the different groupings, clusters?
Yep, exactly, yeah. Okay. So it's all... it's all defined by you, the organization, or by you, the client.
And then then you're using keywords in the organizational names?
Exactly.
To define what you want to see. Okay. How are you using the channel source report? Same way?
We're using it similarly to understand where people are coming from. I actually use it quite frequently as a gut check. So because I work on our social media side, I say this tweet got really good engagement, that must have driven traffic to the website. And if you go and look back, you can say, oh, maybe it didn't actually do so well, or yes, this did perform, it did send people back to the website. One thing that was interesting is that we have a much bigger Twitter following than a Facebook following, but we actually get more traffic from Facebook than we do from Twitter, which means that maybe we want to change our strategy so that on Twitter, we're using that to share announcements and things that we want people to make viral or spread more broadly. And then on Facebook, maybe we're using that for more call to actions or getting people to the website.
Mm. Okay. Would you conclude from that your Facebook users are more engaged, though fewer in number, than your Twitter users? Twitter followers?
It's a good question. I think it's just that the platforms serve different purposes. I think that Twitter is more about staying on the platform and maybe Facebook isn't in our case. I don't think that's necessarily true for everyone.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else we should say about the channel source report?
I don't think so. I mean, the key to it is really using it to adjust your marketing strategy. So once you see how people are getting to your site, making sure that you're adjusting your approach to marketing based on... the kind of return that you're getting from that investment in those different channels.
All right. Julia, you want to introduce the next report?
The next report, let's see, we did audiences.
What are they looking for? The search reports?
Right, yeah. So search reports, and you can do this in a couple different ways. So one is to go into your SEO and look at the search terms that people are using on Google to get to your website. And then you can also do an internal search report. So if you have a search function on your website, you can go in and see all the keywords that people used when they got on your website, what they were looking for once they got on your website.
Okay. Is this also something that you have to set up in a back end?
Analytics.
When using the Google Analytics, yeah, not when you're searching on your own, obviously on your own site, within your own site.
But, exactly.
But okay, so you set up another...
So in the report, in the search engine optimization report is basically what it's called, SEO queries, you have to kind of connect it with this Webmaster Tools account that Google gives you, which is totally separate from Google Analytics. And then it'll give you more information about not only what words people are using in Google when they got to your site, but even just that your organization appeared in a search result, whether or not someone actually clicked it from Google into your site.
Whether or not someone actually clicked it. Okay. I don't feel like I have a grasp on this one as well as I did the first two.
Yeah.
Why is that?
Yeah, so think about anybody...
This is not one report. This is searching. This is not a report that Google Analytics produces, is it?
It does, yeah. So the report, what it looks like, is a bunch of search queries. So that could be everything from, you know, what is nonprofit radio, to how do I get help with Google Analytics? And if this podcast was you know, posted on the website, and it, you know, was...
appropriately tagged.
Exactly, it was appropriately tagged and kind of had all the right keywords. You could actually see what words people were using in a Google search to find that piece of content. And so the kind of point of our conversation or during the session was look at the content needs of your users and make sure your website is delivering on those needs. So we went through an example of searching just for the word or the words who, what, where, when, why, and how in all of your Google search results and see what are those questions people have about your content that they want answered and make sure that you're actually answering those questions on your website.
Okay. Oh, that helps. Thank you. You're bringing me along. Thank you. Both of you. Thank you. Julia, your experience with the search report?
I would say there's two things. The first is that it helped us understand when we had a report, that an actual research report that was well-titled, it would get a lot more downloads or hits directly from Google because people were searching, you know, how do you do this thing? And the report would be how to do this thing.
Yeah.
And so those
yeah.
would come up a lot more. So it's learning better titles is one thing or sort of better tagging, better content in that way. And then the other one is learning the gaps. So what are people searching for both on your website or on Google and you're not providing it to them?
And how would you know that in the report?
So for the internal, if it's internal search, so on your own site, maybe they're searching for a term and you know that that term isn't on the website, maybe you start creating some content related to that.
Okay.
Or maybe you more closely match the words that people are using from Google so that you appear higher in search or so it looks, so that you are look like a better resource for them to click on.
Okay, okay. And you could do that within tags too, right?
You could do that.
Meta tags?
You can do that in meta tags, you can do that in the title, you can do that in the URL, and also in the body of whatever the page is.
Okay, okay.
So sometimes it's just about using the language that your audience is using instead of your own kind of internal jargon.
Right.
So we went through a recent project with BSR around women's inequality, women's impact on the economy, and there were lots of different opportunities. So you could think about gender inequality, female inequality, just women, girls. You could think about using lots of different terms in your content, but actually look to see what words your users are actually using in their own language, and then try to adapt more of your content to their language patterns.
Yeah, for sure. It doesn't matter what you're talking about in the office.
Exactly.
You're not the ones who we're trying to bring to the cause and to our content.
Right.
All right.
So this report helps
you
figure out what that language is that they're using.
Right. Excellent. All right. Very good. Fourth, what's our last report?
What did they do on your site? So did they download something? Did they give money to you? What are the kind of events that happened on your website?
What's this one called? You got to give me a title. What?
So it's in the behavior section, and then events is the name of the report.
Oh, it's called events? That's another badly named one.
It is.
All right. Events. Shoot. All right. So what is it? They consider people traveling through your site to be an event.
Yeah, so this
multiple events, I guess.
This gets technical. Any non-URL-based change is an event. So if you think about someone browsing your site, they go from one page to another page, not an event. If they take some action on a page that doesn't result in a new URL, that's an event. So that could be scrolling down the page is an event. Clicking on a button could be an event. Clicking on an anchor link that like drops you down the page suddenly is an event. Anything that happens on the page that doesn't result in you moving to a new page is an event.
So I always thought this was totally untrackable.
That's all trackable.
My scrolling down on a page is tracked.
That is one of the topics we cover in the session. That's called scroll depth tracking, and we actually provide the front-end code that you need to install on your website so that you can see how far down every page on your website people scrolled for a particular piece of content.
This is incredible. I always thought that only clicks, which I guess would result in a new page, were trackable, but I was vastly wrong.
Yeah, so about
grossly wrong.
So about a third of the session ended up covering event tracking and how to implement new code on your website so that you actually can track all these events.
Okay. Is that anywhere that listeners can find?
It is.
The code? Where?
Slideshare.net/DevonVSmith.
Slideshare.net/Devon, D-E-V-O-N, V, Smith.
Yep, that's correct. You can download all the slides from the session, and it has all the code there
for
you.
Whoa. That's incredible. All right, so what do you do with, now you know on whatever page people scroll only 25% of the way, and another page they scroll 33% of the way, and, mm-hmm. and that's only scrolling. What else? Wait, tell me what else was trackable? I know generally any non-URL
yes.
changing event, but so, or item, which is an event. Because if you don't change URLs,
yep.
it's an event.
Yep.
Okay, what are the events besides scrolling?
So you could look at clicking a button on the site, and that might like give you like a pop-up form, or you might submit an email address and then go on to something else. You can even use event tracking if you're like have an event registration system. That's a third-party platform. If you want to see what other sites people go to from your website to some third-party platform, that would be event tracking. Yeah, anything that's not just going to a new page on your site can
okay.
be an event.
Okay. This is vast. Julia, what do you
yes.
do with this?
So we actually use probably the biggest one for us is report downloads because we have a lot of research reports. And so that helps us track how many reports are getting downloaded versus people just going to the page, looking at the page, and then going somewhere else. So there's the you know the page that has the report on it, and then you click on it to download. Not everybody downloads. So it's good to know who's doing that. I think scroll depth is great because it means that it can help understand if we should change the design or layout of the page so that the most important information is up top or understanding how far people get down the page. Maybe we adjust what the page looks like or what information we put where depending on what we think is the most important thing.
Okay. Anything else? I mean, there's a ton of stuff in this.
Yeah, it's a pretty
report.
Big one. There's also contact. So when people contact us, it's good to know which we have a bunch of different contacts for, you know, if you want to do a research report, if you're from a specific industry, we have a lot of different people you can talk to. So the ones that are the most popular, maybe we'll put that button somewhere that's more prominent or we'll ensure that the person who's on the other end of that is properly responding to all of those emails.
Okay. Ladies, we're going to wrap it up there because this was slightly technical and you know, without visuals.
It's pretty wonky.
Yeah. All right. This is about as technical as we get, but the perfect place to end it with Julia. And again, slideshare.net/Devin V. Smith. Okay, we've said it three times. And Devin V. Smith is co-founder at Measure Creative and Julia Robinson, manager communications at BSR. Business, is it business or businesses?
Business.
Business for social responsibility. Ladies, thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Tony.
Cool. All right. Tony Martinetti, nonprofit radio coverage of 16 NTC, the Nonprofit Technology Conference. Thank you so much for being with us.
Gene Takagi and What's Permissible Advocacy coming up. First, Pursuant and Crowdster. Pursuant has a free webinar coming up. They're inviting you. Donor Relations the Disney Way. If Walt Disney was your CEO, how would you treat your donors? How would you inspire your staff? What would you do differently? The webinar is on May 3rd. Registration and info are at tony.ma/pursuantdisney. Have you checked out Crowdster for your next peer-to-peer event? Maybe that's a run walk. I just referred someone to Crowdster for a lacrosse tournament. Their microsites and dashboards are they're simple, they're elegant, easy, and flexible for your donors and for their friends who, of course, they're drawing in, right? It's the whole purpose of this. They're drawing their networks in. Easy for everybody to use. The back end is easy, and that's important for your oversight of the campaign. They added Apple Pay for mobile donations. You can talk to the CEO, Joe. Joe, the CEO. joe.ferraro@crowdster.com. Tell him you're from Nonprofit Radio. And when did you get to the CEO of Kickstarter? Never going to happen. Now time for Tony's Take Two. My video this week is another story from my client Baruch College. An alum asked about including the college in his will. We answered his questions. We gave him what he needed. And indeed, he put a bequest in his will for the college. Then he emailed us and told us about the three colleges that didn't answer his questions. Ah, what happened to them? The video is at tonymartinetti.com. If you want to be a Nonprofit Radio insider, if you want to get advance notice of the guests and an advanced link to my weekly videos, also go to tonymartinetti.com and in the upper right, click the email icon. That's Tony's Take Two. Time for Live Listener Love, Podcast Pleasantries, and Affiliate Affections. I know you didn't think that I forgot them. Perish the thought. I know you didn't. Live Listener Love is going out to, oh my goodness, oh, a whole new list. Sam gave me a double, but I thought, whoa, San Francisco, California, San Jose, Portland, Oregon, Bensalem, Pennsylvania, or is it Bensalem? That sounds like Benson Mum. That's from, what was that movie? That's from Murder by Death, Benson Mum. Anyway, Bensalem, Pennsylvania, Denver, Colorado, Wilmington, North Carolina. I'm going to be there very shortly, not Wilmington proper, but my new home in Emerald Isle. We got New Yorkers. We got New York, New York, Brooklyn, New York, and Staten Island, New York. That's three of the five boroughs. Where are Queens and Queens and the Bronx? Don't know. Not with us. But Staten Island, Manhattan, and Brooklyn are. Focus on the positive. Albany, New York, upstate, and St. Louis, Missouri. Thank you so much. Lots of domestic live listener love today. Love it. We got Brazil has checked in. Brazil, we don't hear from Brazil all that often. So I'm going to say, is it Buenos Tardes? Would that be correct? No, that's Spanish. That's right. Brazil, of course, you speak Portuguese. So I'll just shout out the city. São Luís de Montes, Brazil. Thank you so much for being with us.
That's Portuguese.
What is it, Portuguese?
Obrigado.
Obrigado. Obrigado. Thank you. Our Hojan, our intern. Thank you. We're going to Asia. Seoul, of course, always counting on Seoul, South Korea. So generous. Annyeonghaseyo. And also in China, Beijing and Taiyun. Ni hao. Naturally, Tokyo is with us. Always counting on Tokyo, too. Konnichiwa. Lots of live listener love today. Love it. Affiliate Affections, that comes next in the same breath. I mean, it's all the same. You know, it's just there's no distinction, really, between the love and the affection and the pleasantries. It's all the same. I just I get carried away with alliterations, that's all. Affiliate Affections, our AM and FM listeners throughout the country, love you. Thank you so much for being with us, whatever time your station is playing us, whatever day. So glad you're with us on AM and FM, those terrestrial listeners. And the podcast pleasantries are over 10,000. Whatever event, whatever device, whatever day, whenever you're listening, binge listening. I was talking to a binge listener on Twitter last week. She was catching up with like the last six episodes or so. 6 hours of nonprofit radio. Love it. Podcast pleasantries to those listeners. Gene Takagi is with us. I know he's there. You know him. He's the managing editor, managing attorney of NEO, the Nonprofit and Exempt Organizations Law Group in San Francisco. And he edits the popular nonprofitlawblog.com, which is a very popular blog, by the way. Nonprofitlawblog.com gets a lot of traffic. Because it's there's smart info there. It's done by Gene and his firm. And on Twitter, you want to check him on Twitter? He's at GTAK, GTAK. Welcome back, Gene Takagi.
Thanks, Tony. Hi.
Hey, how you doing out there, San Francisco?
Doing great, and nice cool. To hear all the love, affection, and pleasantries out there.
Yes, thank you. Oh, you segmented them. Thank you. See, that's how gracious you are. Thank you. I love it. So we're talking, Gene, because we're in the presidential election cycle, very, very timely about advocacy, what you can do, what's gray area, what you definitely better stay away from. But, you know, nonprofits, you know, they have interest in the outcomes here. I mean, they can't just be totally on the sidelines.
Yeah, absolutely, Tony. And, you know, I think nonprofits... Every one of us, if I include myself in the group as being a board member.
Absolutely, absolutely.
We all support and promote some cause, right? I think that's just natural with nonprofit organizations. We're furthering our mission. We've got to support and promote our cause. And I think particularly with some of your audience, Tony, fundraisers know that more than anybody.
I'm sure they do. Absolutely.
But you know, I think you know, supporting and promoting our cause goes beyond just talking to prospective donors. It goes to talking to the general public and making sure that they're aware. And we really can't forget about the policymakers, like the legislators and even the administrative agencies out there, because they set all of the rules for our playing field. And as nonprofits, we want to make sure that the rules take into account our organizations and communities' needs as well, because the laws can sometimes be on our side. And sometimes they can be very much against what we want to do.
Of course.
And you know, what nonprofits have done in the past, I mean, we're really responsible as a community for really the most important public policies that we hold most dear to us and that really shape our country, like civil rights, women's rights, disability rights, education, health, religion, environmental protection, animal welfare. You know, no matter what our causes are, a lot of that has been shaped by the nonprofit sectors. It's just groups of individuals coming together in an organized manner and telling the lawmakers out there, be aware of our needs and our causes. We reflect 10% of the employed population in America. We are a strong bloc out there, and our views are important to us, and the public thinks our views are important as well. So holding potential elected officials accountable for promoting the issues that we have is important, and we can do a lot in an election year. I know a lot of organizations are afraid because 501c3 is all about, like, you can't engage in substantial lobbying and you can't endorse political candidates, but there's still a lot you can do.
Yeah. What, Gene, what an articulate and heartfelt endorsement of what our nonprofit community sector is all about. Really, that was very touching. That was wonderful. You're absolutely right. I mean, the only thing you didn't mention is between 10 and 15% of our gross domestic product is held in assets or flows through the nonprofit community every year, which is around $1.5 trillion or so. So that was really, I could feel the emotion in that, Gene. I know why you do the work you do. I mean, I've known for years, but I felt it. Wonderful. Yes, and absolutely. Yeah, there are things that we can do. Now, the things that are some potential places where you can you might be participating in some areas, they're basically ones that either have, I think, direct impact on you as an organization or your mission or those who you're serving. Did I sort of encapsulate that?
Right? Yeah, I think that's spot on. And I'll just give you an example of a board I used to serve on, and I termed DOS. It was a fantastic organization that worked with children and youth in San Francisco. There was a local budget cut to services to children and youth. The leadership of the nonprofit quickly organized parents and told them to bring all of their kids along to City Hall the next day. About 200 showed up with their kids, and they also invited the news crews to come out there as well. Well, within a week, budget cut restored back to children.
Yes, all right.
So really, that's advocacy in action, and advocacy totally makes a difference, whether you're talking about a small nonprofit or a large nonprofit, and you likely have a lot of friends out there. So really important things you can do out there.
Yeah. I thank you for saying that you got termed off the board. You weren't thrown out.
Right, exactly.
Which would be a huge mistake. I mean, I wouldn't even let you term off a board. I would amend the bylaws to keep Gene Takagi. I would explicitly say Gene Takagi lifetime or as long as desired. But I don't run it. That's why I'm not an executive director or CEO. So all right, so budget cuts are good. If there's a law too, right? If there's a law that's going to affect you as an organization or the people you're serving, you know, those can be advocated too as well, right? As well as budget.
Yeah, I mean, I think of all the nonprofit listeners out there right now, and what does minimum wage laws? How does that impact the people you serve? Equality, equal access, you know, environmental stuff, federal government funding. Just a couple years ago, and it just got put into regs last year, about recognizing the need for federal grants to start to pay for your overhead as well. I mean, before, it could escape. You know, government wanted to pay for your programs. They didn't want to pay for any of your overhead. And now there was kind of recognition, and thanks to advocacy by nonprofits, saying, recognize that we can only run programs with some overhead. This isn't an all-volunteer effort. So all of those things are laws that affect mission, the people you serve. And I'll just give you another example because it's just a little bit outrageous. And this one is from California, but it could spread into multiple states. And there's a bill right now that originally proposed that every nonprofit raising funds in California, no matter whether they were located in California or not, if they raised funds in California, they had to put their overhead figures on their website. And now that bill is changed because that was probably unconstitutional. But now that bill is changed, and it's still being running through committees right now, of effectively requiring that every nonprofit who's raising funds in California, again, regardless of where you're located in the nation, if you raise funds here, on every single fundraising document you send out, every letter, every mailing, every postcard, anything, every email, you've got to put a consumer protection warning label on it.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
So that's a ridiculous law that affects your organization, that creates costs. And, again, probably unlawful anyway, but without nonprofits standing up and saying, hey, you're really hurting the communities that we serve, not just us. You know, and these are based on a few, you know, bad examples of some nonprofit scandals that hit the newspapers, and some legislators want to jump on that. You've got to push back.
Yeah, California is remarkable. I mean, it's so progressive in some respects, and then so I guess the progressivism becomes so extreme that it becomes burdensome. I mean, and burdensome and deleterious.
Yeah, you know, just some people are,
I don't know, extreme progressivism,
misinformed or just don't have enough information, and they make laws that they think are, you know, going to make them champions of consumers, and they're just not looking at the big picture. And nonprofits have got to educate lawmakers.
Yeah, you and I talked months ago about the charity registration requirement that all if you were fundraising in California, you had to comply or be subject to your activities being ceased and then transferred to other agencies if it was an extreme case. Where does that one stand, Gene?
That one actually passed. An administrative regulation. Not enough nonprofits, you know, probably knew about it and spoke up against that, and that actually passed through the Attorney General's office. We don't know how it's going to be enforced, but yeah, it's board member personal liability if you continue to spend money and you're suspended or you're not properly registered, and that could affect, you know, literally a couple hundred thousand organizations.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. I don't know if we have to revisit that one because it has impact. It has import outside California, does it not?
Yeah, you know, whenever one state makes a law, and if it's not really seen as an outlier in California, because you noted that it's known as a progressive organization or progressive state, so, you know, other states going, well, we should be able to pass laws like that as well, which sound quite conservative and not so progressive.
Yeah, right. Right.
And so, yes, you have a big state like California passing fairly draconian laws, and that can spread throughout the states as other charities, regulators,
all right, maybe
or legislative bodies think about that.
Maybe we want to talk about that next time.
Sure.
Okay. It's interesting. The political spectrum, it bends so far that the left meets the right. I think we're seeing that in some of the presidential media coverage, too. But in any case, okay, let's continue with advocacy. Let's talk about some things that are permissible actual activities, not just things that you could be advocating about, but like bills and laws, et cetera. But we just have about 2 minutes before a break. So let's just start to get into the subject of some of the activities that you can actually do.
Yeah, so let's talk about first stating the organization's position on a public policy issue. So we listed a bunch of them earlier. So let's say it's equal rights. Like, you can state that position, and in an election year, it may get more visibility than it might in another year. So, you know, whether it be gun control or better schools or, you know, women and minority in positions of power, whatever it is, state your organization's positions on public policy issues and continue doing so during an election year. That's absolutely okay.
Okay, so stating on your website, on your Facebook page, et cetera, that's permissible.
Yeah, absolutely. Not just to in your fundraising documents, but just, you know, to get your mission out there and to make sure everybody's educated about it.
Okay. I'll tell you what. Let's take our break now, and we'll come back. We got a lot more permissible advocacy to talk about with Gene. Stay with us.
Like what you're hearing on Nonprofit Radio? Tony's got more. On YouTube, you'll find clips from his stand-up comedy, TV spots, and exclusive interviews. Catch guests like Seth Godin, Craig Newmark, the founder of Craigslist, Mark Echo of Echo Enterprises, Charles Best from DonorsChoose.org, Aria Finger of DoSomething.org, and Naomi Levine from New York University's Hyman Center on Philanthropy. Tony tweets, too. He finds the best content from the most knowledgeable and interesting people in and around nonprofits to share on his stream. If you have valuable info, he wants to retweet you. During the show, you can join the conversation on Twitter using hashtag Nonprofit Radio. Twitter is an easy way to reach Tony. He's at Tony Martinetti, MARTIGNETTI. Remember, there's a G before the N. He hosts a podcast for the Chronicle of Philanthropy. Fundraising Fundamentals is a short, monthly show devoted to getting you over your fundraising hurdles. Just like Nonprofit Radio, Tony talks to leading thinkers, experts, and cool people with great ideas. As one fan said, Tony picks their brains and I don't have to leave my office. Fundraising Fundamentals was recently dubbed the most helpful nonprofit podcast you have ever heard. You can also join the conversation on Facebook, where you can ask questions before or after the show. The guests are there too. Get insider show alerts by email. Tony tells you who's on each week and always includes links so that you can contact guests directly. To sign up, visit the Facebook page or TonyMartinetti.com.
I'm Dana Ostemel, CEO of Deposit a Gift, and you're listening to Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio, big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.
Welcome back to Big Nonprofit Ideas for the Other 95%. Thank you very much, Dana Ostemel. Okay, Gene. You can put your position out there. That's totally fine, even if it's something controversial, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. What else? But let's talk a little about lobbying, can we?
Sure. Yeah. So certainly we can attempt to influence legislation, including ballot measures, and there's certain limitations involved. But charities actually have pretty broad and generous limits with respect to their lobbying. The code, again, 501c3, says no substantial lobbying, really, and that scares a lot of organizations, so that most charities don't engage in any lobbying at all. But lobbying really is influencing legislation, so influencing the creation of laws or getting rid of laws or proposing new laws. The attempt to influence that is generally called lobbying, and certainly nonprofits, when laws are going to directly impact them in the many ways we talked about, should attempt to influence legislation, and they can. And if they make something called the 501H election, that's a way of measuring lobbying where lobbying is just measured on expenditures. It doesn't look at volunteer activities or what portion of your website or your staff is devoted to lobbying. It just looks at how much you spend on lobbying, and that's how much the limit is. It's very, very clear. It's very easy to elect, and we recommend that for any charity that's really got less than a $20 million annual budget.
So okay.
Pretty much all public charities, except the really, really big ones. 501H election, it's form 5768 from the IRS. Sorry for the technical jargon, but it's like a half-page form, the easiest form that the IRS has. And it's just my strongest recommendation for any group, so you can engage in lobbying and feel really safe about it.
Okay, cool. A 501H election. So what's the number of the form again, one more time?
IRS form 5768. Just Google it, and it'll be right there.
Outstanding. All right, cool. Love that. All right, so lobbying, wide open. Now, lobbying could be laws, it could also be regulations, right? Like that Attorney General regulation in California that regrettably passed. But it could be either one.
Yeah, great point. So the limitation, the lobbying law limitations that say you can't engage in substantial lobbying only refers to legislative laws, so not the administrative laws, which come from an executive branch of the government. So for executive actions and administrative regulations, you can advocate changes in those without limits. As long as it's in furtherance of your mission, you can go ahead and do it to your heart's content. No limitations on that.
Oh, wow. Okay, that is not considered lobbying. All right, so any agency regulation?
Right, IRS, Environmental Protection Agency, Federal Trade Commission, all of that stuff, and
right.
state and local as well.
Yeah, state. Okay, as long as it's not coming out of your state capital or your city legislature, but like you said, non-executive branch, right?
Or executive branch, right.
Or it's coming executive from the executive branch, not the legislative. Sorry.
Right.
My fourth grade civics class. Okay. yes. It's coming from the executive branch of local, state, or federal. Okay. So that's really, regulations are enormous. I mean, the IRS operates on the Internal Revenue Code. That's a vast regulation body.
There's lots to advocate on in the code. Yeah.
Okay. So regulations are wide open. And then for the laws, of course, we've got our 501H. Okay.
And let me not misstate that educational activity is probably the main way you engage in advocacy. So not just stating your position, but educating the public, educating lawmakers, educating candidates even. That's okay. You can provide a briefing to them on the organization's issues and priorities. Absolutely fine, as long as you do it in a nonpartisan manner. So just give it out to all your candidates so that they're aware, hey, maybe those nonprofits' constituencies are really looking at this issue. So you're not telling them how to vote. You're not asking them for them to take a position. You're just giving them information, but about the organization's issues and priorities, and you're just educating them.
Okay. So educational activities, we could host events to promote our opinion of homelessness or something like that?
Yeah, absolutely. You can hold events, and if you want, you can invite all the candidates. Now, if you have them speak, there are going to be certain things that you're going to have to require. But yeah, as long as it's done in a nonpartisan manner, you can be super big advocates on your issues.
Okay, or you don't even have to have candidates, but you can have issue nights to educate the public.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, and they don't have to be directly related to your mission work.
Yeah, I mean, they should advance your mission in some way.
Okay.
All your activities should advance your mission in some way. But yeah, they don't have to necessarily be pinpoint. Exactly,
yeah, okay. Like you said earlier, minimum wage, for instance.
Right.
Okay. We could take a stand on minimum wage. You know, maybe we don't work with people in poverty, but we have employees, and we believe they should be paid a living wage. And we believe all organizations and companies in the state should pay a living wage. So we're advocating for increasing the minimum wage in our state. Is that okay?
If your organization is sort of has a broad mission of working for mission of community values and families and things like that, yeah, absolutely. Minimum wage impacts all of that stuff.
Okay. So we're lobbying, and then the administrative changes, which is not considered lobbying. So I want to watch my terms here because I'm talking to an attorney. So advocating for the regulations, that's not lobbying, but it's vast. And then you got your lobbying for laws, and you got your education activities, all permissible, right?
Right.
Okay. Should we switch gears to what you can't do? Oh, wait, no.
That's a good idea.
Okay, but before we do that, let's talk about what individuals who are employees of your organization can do.
Oh, excellent. So, yeah, what we talk about impermissible for nonprofits doesn't mean it's impermissible for their employees or board members as individuals. So, yeah, everybody has First Amendment rights. So, of course, individuals can endorse candidates and support candidates all they want. And they just have to be careful if their organizations are put next to their name in terms of, like, supporting a particular political candidate, that there's some sort of footnote, and listeners probably have seen this before, some sort of footnote that says that the name of the organization is there for identification purposes only and is not an endorsement by the organization of that candidate.
Okay. Don't use the organization name. Okay. We just have about a minute and a half left. We got to run through what's impermissible. I know endorsing a candidate, you can't do it.
Right. So easy ones. No endorsements, no contributions to a candidate, and not just money, but using other organizational resources. And that gets subtle sometimes. So don't let your employees use their organizational email address to engage in their First Amendment rights to electioneer. They got to use their private email for stuff like that.
Okay. Give us some more impermissible.
Sure. Be careful of working on a wedge issue that you haven't been working on all year. So it's an issue the candidates in a particular election have a differing opinion upon, and that may pivot the way the election results come out. And you've not campaigned on that issue or done any advocacy all year, and all of a sudden, 2 weeks before the election, you start doing it.
Yes.
That looks like that's really electioneering.
Okay.
Getting candidates to sign pledges on an issue or endorse the organization's agenda, coordinating activities with candidates, evaluating or grading candidate positions, those are all impermissible.
All bad. Okay. We got to leave it there, Gene Takagi. Thank you so much. Oh, we squeezed it in, but we covered a lot. Thank you very much, Gene.
Great. Thanks so much, Tony.
My pleasure, always. You'll find him at the nonprofitlawblog.com and on Twitter at GTAC. Next week, your emotional intelligence and peer-to-peer fundraising tips. If you missed any part of today's show, I entreat you, find it on TonyMartinetti.com. Where in the world else would you go? Please show me the path. I need to know the way with this. We're sponsored by Pursuant, online tools for small and mid-sized nonprofits, data-driven and technology-enabled, Pursuant.com. And by Crowdster, online and mobile fundraising software for nonprofits, now with Apple Pay for mobile donations. Crowdster.com. Our creative producer is Claire Meyerhoff. Sam Leibowitz is the line producer. Gavin Dahl is our AM and FM outreach director. The show's social media is by Susan Chavez. And this outstanding music is by Scott Stein. Thank you for that affirmation, Scotty. Be with me next week for Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%. Go out and be great.
What's not to love about Nonprofit Radio? Tony gets the best guests. Check this out from Seth Godin.
This is the first revolution since TV 1950 and Henry Ford 1920. It's the revolution of our lifetime.
Here's a smart, simple idea from Craigslist founder Craig Newmark.
Yeah, in sites or in presentation or anything, people don't really need the fancy stuff. They need something which is simple and fast.
When's the best time to post on Facebook? Facebook's Andrew Noyes knows.
At traffic is at an all-time high around 9 a.m. or 8 p.m. So that's when you should be posting your most meaningful posts.
Here's Aria Finger, COO of DoSomething.org.
Young people are not going to be involved in social change if it's boring and they don't see the impact of what they're doing. So you got to make it fun and applicable to these young people. Because otherwise, a 15 and 16-year-old, they have better things to do. They have Xbox, they have TV, they have their cell phones.
Ami Dar is the founder of Idealist.
It took 2 or 3 years for foundation staff to sort of deign to add an email address to their card. Yes. It was like, it was phone. This email thing is right. Weird. Plus, why should I give it away?
Charles Best founded DonorsChoose.org.
Somehow they've gotten in touch, kind of offline, as it were.
Yeah.
And they'll do exchanges of brownies and visits and physical gift.
Mark Echo is the founder and CEO of Echo Enterprises. You may be wearing his hoodies and shirts. Tony talked to him.
Yeah, you know, I'm a big believer that it's not what you make in life. It's you know, it's how you make people feel.
This is public radio host Majora Carter.
Innovation is in the power of understanding that you don't just, you know, you just put money on a situation and expect it to heal. You put money on a situation and invest it and expect it to grow.
And savvy advice for success from Eric Saperston.
What separates those who achieve from those who do not is in direct proportion to one's ability to ask others for help.
The smartest experts and leading thinkers are on Tony Martinetti Nonprofit Radio. Big nonprofit ideas for the other 95%.